I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/acast. That's burrow.com/acast. burrow.com/acast.
Spring is my favorite time to start a new workout routine. With the weather warming up, it feels easier to get into the rhythm of things. Whether you have 20 minutes or an hour for a Pilates class or outdoor guided walk, Peloton has everything you need to help you get going. Get a head start on summer with Peloton at onepeloton.com.
Welcome to Mischief Makers, your one-stop shop for all things mischief. Join your host, Dave Hearn, as he finds out what makes mischief, well, mischief.
Right, we're starting now.
Okay, one sec.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome back to another episode of Mischief Makers with me, Dave Hearn. You might hear some crazy rustling going on in the background, and that's because I am with the wonderful Josh Elliott today, or should I say Dr. Josh Elliott. He wanted to get a jumper before we began because it's quite cold in his room. So I said, go off and get the jumper, I'll do the intro, and when you come back, hello Josh.
Hi.
There he is, he's back in the room. Do you have a jumper on now?
I'm wearing a quite thick jumper, yeah.
Very good. That is very good because I suppose as a doctor, do you recommend, I don't know, could you medically prescribe a jumper? That'd be silly.
That's step one of all of my medical reviews. Oh, they're wearing a jumper. No. Step one, jumper.
Wear a jumper. Wear a thick knit jumper.
Yeah. Just for the psychological benefits as well, I think.
Do you feel better psychologically if you've got a good jumper on?
Specifically a thick knit one. Yeah, I think so. Well, one of the, I can't remember who said it during the Mischief Movie Night run we just did, said that they're like seeing the boys in the thick knits over, that sounds so raunchy. But...
I like the boys in their thick knits.
But I like the feel of a thick knit.
Yeah, that's true. I've got a sort of submariner's roll neck.
I know the one, I've seen you in a thick knit, Dave, and it's I also appreciate nice. You in a thick knit.
I
feel a bit like Hemingway.
Huh? Yeah, I do, because I've actually taken my jumper off before this. For fear of
being too David. Hot. Yeah, so, I'll probably get too hot out of excitement.
Now, are you all right to start? I mean, I appreciate we have started, but it's not the most settling way to begin, because
no.
I just sort of sent you off running. Settled now, are you comfortable?
Yeah, I'm worried about this, a little bit creaky in this chair, but that's all right. I'll just stay still.
Give us an example of the creak.
That's subtle creak.
It's not too bad, actually. What's a not subtle creak? I knew that was what you were going to do. You were going to do mouth creak.
Yeah, I felt like mouth creak. Because you know that's my go-to.
What, mouth creak or mouth comedy?
Mouth creak. I don't know, mouth creak? I meant mouth creak. I was being silly, but maybe mouth comedy.
Well, yeah. Well, we've derailed already.
Sorry.
No, this is fine. This is good. It's me. I'm getting absorbed into jumper and mouth creak business. Now, Josh, welcome to the podcast.
David Hearn, thank you.
You are a founding member of Mischief, amongst many other things.
Correct.
There in the very, very early days back in, was it 2008 or 2007 did it kind of start? It was 2008, wasn't it?
When was the first Edinburgh after the Lambda Foundation?
It was 2008.
Must have been 2008.
Yeah.
I was trying to think before this, who was in that foundation year that is currently in it still? You, so me, Henry Lewis,
yeah.
Harry Kershaw, Mike Bodie.
Yeah, I think that's it.
Wow.
Because Niall and Bri joined later, Rob joined later. Charlie and Jono, to be fair, joined like after that first Edinburgh run. It was like 6 months after.
Yeah.
But yeah, pretty much of the, I mean, I guess, you know, if you're talking like comic book OG,
yeah,
then it's like the Us Five, I think.
Yeah, we're the origin story, yeah.
Yeah, and you can't get rid of Harry Kershaw. He's like a whelk.
He's like a knot in an old oak.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Exactly. Wise and embedded.
Yeah, and he'll tear up your chainsaw if you go at him.
Yes, he will. Yes, he will. Now, Josh, this first section we're going to go into, we're just going to get to know you a little bit so that the fans of Mischief can get to know Josh Elliott. And you might know this already. I'm sure you've extensively studied the previous podcast that I've done.
Yeah.
I don't have any jingles, and I know you're quite musically minded, so could you just improvise a quick sort of 3 to 5 second sort of radio jingle titled Getting to Know You?
Getting to Know You. Welcome.
Nice. It was quite like a staccato. I enjoyed it.
Well, you know, just kind of mix it up a little bit.
It was good. It was good. Well, there's going to be two more jingles, so keep
your... Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, keep your thinking cap on. But I don't want you to be distracted.
No, I'll try not on, but that is a big, that's a big sword of Damocles hanging over me now.
Well, the other option is you can do the two jingles now, but then you'll need to remember them when we get there.
Oh, that is, no, that's too much again.
Yeah.
I don't know, you call it.
No, I think we'll do it as and when. I think that'll be fun.
Can I just say that I imagine marimbas in the back of that one, sort of like delicate. Sort of, it's like one of those, like a wooden xylophone.
Ah, okay, yeah, yeah. I used to play those in primary school.
Yeah,
with the
bass. Yeah, I was put on bass. What's it called? Steel drum when I was a kid at my primary school.
Oh wow! So rocking some Caribbean vibes.
Yeah, I mean you can't. You can take the Caribbean out of the boy. No, the other way around.
You can take the boy. Have you ever been to the Caribbean?
No, but I did. I did go to. Oh no, you didn't hear that, did you? That was in a thing on my computer. I did go to a school that was very close to the walking path of the festival in... sorry, I'm distracted.
Oh, the Notting Hill Festival.
Notting Hill Festival, yeah.
What's happening to your computer?
I don't know, lots of emails suddenly coming in. All the fans being like, anticipating this, no doubt.
It's going out live. They know. They're messaging in. So actually, yeah, let's stay on that then. Let's talk about you. So you grew up in West London, right?
Correct.
And were you always, because I know you play quite a lot of music and instruments, so is that kind of how you got into the arts and that kind of background?
So I think my mum was an artist, and my sister as well, my oldest of two sisters. And there was always like this sort of craftsy, wacky energy around my house. We just also, all the art projects... not just the thing itself, but all the materials that went into making that thing would just accumulate around. And so there's always just like weird business, you know? And my sister, older sister Freya, would always encourage me to just do whatever with her. She would use me like a sort of monkey stuntman,
training dummy kind of thing.
Yeah.
And so you were doing like little plays and pieces as a kid.
Yeah, we used to like put on little puppet. I mean, my middle sister as well used to put on like puppet shows. I think that's quite standard, isn't it? And
rock concerts.
And then, to the neighbours. Although I think I was probably too young at some point, and then I got de-invited unofficially from the final gig.
But do you remember that moment? It feels like
There would have been more than one final gig, but there is one specific show that involved the neighbours where I felt like I wasn't really. You know that feeling, you're like, I'm not really, my value here isn't being fully appreciated.
But you were a part of it, but you felt you were undervalued.
I was a part of it, yeah. Yeah, I was a part of it.
Do you remember what your role in that particular performance was?
Probably primarily puppet gatherer.
I see, more of a stagehand than a performer.
Well, I was obviously a frustrated performer. I can't remember all the details, to be honest with you, but there's been a lot. No, but at school, I definitely... I mean, I didn't like, I wasn't, until I was about 17 or 18, I didn't really like go out a huge amount. And I spent most of my time playing music or, like yourself, video games sometimes. You know, my little, I had quite a ragtag bunch of friends who didn't really fit into any specific group.
Right.
And I accumulated those people. Like the sediment at the center of a raindrop, you know?
Yeah, and the raindrop was your sort of social dynamic.
Yeah, yeah.
And you guys were the sediment.
We sedimented together.
Mm. Yeah, yeah. And so you sort of had a kind of Stranger Things-esque gang.
Yeah, okay, I'll go with that. I like it.
Yeah, and well, it's very in vogue at the moment as well, so it makes you sound quite cool, I think.
Yeah, then well, that's what I'm going for.
Yeah, yeah.
But Dave, then, you're too kind.
No, to me, you are. That's the thing.
Oh, David, likewise.
But, so what instruments, because I know you can play quite a few instruments, can't you?
Well, I just sort of like, I mean, if something is unusual to me, I just think, oh, I wonder what that is like. So I started out playing the cello, which mm-hmm. is a beautiful instrument. I only got to grade 7 out of 8 because I was lazy at rehearsing with it, practicing is the word. And then saxophone I picked up when I was like 10 or 11, basically, because I think my mom encouraged me because she thought it was a cool instrument. And I agree, it is a cool instrument. And that came more easily to me, and I just kept up that one longer. And then accordion, a couple of years after that, a piano accordion, partly, I think, because of the films of Jan Tiersen, had a few accordion-involved things. Also, Shockhead of Peter, which was on at the Lyric Hammersmith, which involved a band called the Tiger Lilies, who I became very into. And they sort of wrote the music for that, and it's three people, like a burlesque punk band, who do whiteface and play accordion, and the lead singer sings with a like high falsetto. That was my jam.
That's yeah. I would say I can hear that influence in your in your musical stylings.
Thanks.
So that's quite a real that's a kind of quite a full gamut of instruments. That's a real gift you have. Do you find it quite easy to pick up different instruments?
First of all, thanks. Do I find it easy?
And not in like a modest sense, you know, where people are like, you know, I know so many excellent musicians who are just like, oh, you know, I tinkle on the guitar, and then they pick it up and they're like Eric Clapton. And it's like, no, like I tinkle on the guitar, you can play an instrument. So I suppose like what I'm asking is, even if you think, oh, I'm not as good as like the best people in the world, what instruments would you be comfortable playing?
So I think there's probably a sort of selection bias in that if I was a bit good at something, I would then be like, okay, this is giving me immediate gratification. And then I would become a bit obsessive in my spare time. I'd spend like hours doing a thing. Or I didn't mention, I played like, so my middle sister Tamara, her boyfriend at the time was going to a guitar teacher that was into sort of heavy metal, like very technical guitar. And I went to him. And so I learnt very technical, what they still call cock rock, like 80s sort of baroque influenced metal guitar, which was just, I mean, I wasn't hugely, I thought that music is kind of hilarious and brilliant. It's very theatrical.
Yeah.
But I learned a lot of those sort of those techniques, which I don't play that kind of guitar anymore. But I can't remember what the question was. Oh, am I good at things? Some things.
So yeah, like I picked up a lot of instruments and like
that's... Well, originally I wanted to, so the cello, for instance, is one of the hardest in terms of like octaves, and the fact that there's like on a guitar you usually have the frets unless it's fretless, which is rare, to help you sort of get the intonation right. But it's very, yeah, to get really good at it you need to practice it a lot, and I'm just probably quite lazy. And before that I wanted to play the violin, but I was basically told I was too big and they needed more cellists in my primary school. So I was given a cello.
Too big for the violin. Have too a big the violin. Violin.
Yeah, essentially. That could be the name of my autobiography, big or the violin. First chapter. Too big for the violin.
Too big for the violin. Too small for the double bass.
Yeah, it's true.
In the middle. Get yourself a cello.
Fully average.
And so you're kind of, at this stage, you're sort of playing music and... going from at school, you have a small kind of sediment group of friends. And then you said you didn't really start kind of going out or kind of sort of experiencing things socially until you were kind of 17, 18.
What happened then? Also, okay, basically what happened is that I was social, but with my own little sediment group of friends, the Raindrop Friends. That wasn't what we were called, but that's what we'll call them now.
That's a great name, though, Raindrop Friends.
The Raindrop Gang. And then at 17, I tell you what happened is that the social Venn diagram expanded, because that was when I sort of became friendly with Dan, the singer from the band that I then joined, the Dope and the Thief, who were a two-piece. And those two knew each other since they were like six, Dan and Justin.
Mm. And so they were probably quite comfortable with each other, certainly.
Yeah, I think initially there was resistance about me joining from Justin. I think he thought, like, who is this guy? And I think he wouldn't mind me saying that.
Well, yeah, because you're quite an outlandish character.
I am outlandish. I mean, I'm a weird guy, aren't I?
Gregarious, is that a good word to describe you? Sort of like
the thing is, I am gregarious, but then also, I don't know how to describe myself really. But so I bonded with Dan initially over the films of David Lynch. I don't know if you're a fan.
Yeah,
But yeah, I mean, equally that would be just like I just like the weirdness of life. You know, I like investing in that kind of world, and so we were getting into that kind of stuff. And then he realized that I played sax, and he thought that him and Justin could use a different thing. So then I started gigging with them, and obviously they were much cooler than me. So I was like also exposed to a whole different gang at school.
You're cool, and then the musician types.
Yeah, I mean, not just that. Like they had this whole North London gang, which was very different to my sort of my
sediment,
background.
Raindrop.
Yeah, it was very different to my sediment. That's true.
Yeah.
but I'm so, you know, that was great because, as you know, I continued with that band, The Joker and the Thief, after school, up until...
Yes, and how long was Joker and the Thief running for? Because we went to a couple of your gigs. I've got some of your music. It's really good.
Thanks, Dave. You know what, Dave? I was going to say, it was so nice on a few occasions when I came into, like, what was Lights, Camera, Improvise, now Mischief, Move and I, and you'd be playing the music, and you were like just enjoying it, not for my benefit. That was so lovely.
Oh well, it's my pleasure. I mean, I always really liked it. It's on a kind of playlist I've got, and occasionally when I'm driving, it'll just come on, and I'm like,
oh, that's so nice.
There's my old pal Josh.
Oh,
playing some shredding some sax.
Yeah, occasionally shredding some sax.
Yeah,
I do miss. You know, I was thinking. I think that's something recently. I mean, I've been really lucky to be involved. Being a doctor, being involved in the comedy again, because I was missing it. But then I also, in the last few years, have probably just not made the time, where it's hard to make the time to do the music, and I definitely miss it.
Yeah, because I suppose you're doing, because we had a conversation about this, didn't we, about kind of the sort of practical responsibility for you as a medical professional versus the kind of creative part of your brain that you kind of want to explore and release a little bit. But actually, I think we'll come back to that. Let's circle back to combining those two things, and let's actually just continue to track your journey from. So you're playing music, you're in a band called Joker and the Thief, and then presumably next stage is the foundation course at Lambda, where you and
That's right.
What was your experience of Lambda and making that move into drama school?
I'm so glad I did that, because obviously I wouldn't have met any of you guys or. Mm. Been part of this, or it would have happened, but so my mum suggested Lambda to me. Actually, I hadn't really thought about it. I it was always on the cards. I was going to go to medical school. My dad's a doctor, my sister was a doctor, my grandfather's a doctor, and I was like good at sciences and I found them interesting. I also enjoyed like English literature and stuff though. And I didn't want to go straight into medical school because I don't know, I wanted to explore other parts of me. So I applied to an art foundation, the Wimbledon Art Foundation, and I applied to Lambda. I was so clueless, naive about drama schools that I, this is ridiculous in hindsight, but I didn't know that you even needed to like have prepared a modern or a, you know, Shakespeare or whatever.
Oh, what, so like my audition?
Yeah, for the audition process. So Harry Kershaw was in, I told this recently on some Instagram chat thing we were doing, but Harry was in the room, and it was one of the most embarrassing experiences of my life, because there's like 30 people in the room, and I didn't know what, you know, everyone else had their speeches prepared. Anyway, it was a miracle that I got in. Obviously, it was a foundation, so they weren't just looking for actors, I guess, and they saw something weird and interesting about me. Part of that foundation audition was an improv thing, which I automatically enjoyed, I should say.
Yeah, I remember that, actually. I remember being put with someone who was literally just, I was just like, we're in a boat. She was just like, nah, we're not. I was like, okay, strong opening. But I think I would be better equipped to deal with it now. But at the time, I was furious. I was like, what are you doing? and I came out of it really angry, but now I'm just like, oh, you know, should probably just panicking.
I don't know, Dave. It is infuriating to watch and to be a part of. I mean, it's obviously not happened to me for a long time now because I only really improvise with you guys, but, you know, especially if you're, I did a bit of teaching of some improv workshops back in the day, and you just feel so sorry for people that are really passionate about it, and then the scene partner just,
it's just like, know,
smug as well, smugly just being like, no. Do you know what I mean?
Just killing everyone or making bad jokes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Hold on, I'm still hung up on, so hang on, right, your mum is like, go to Lambda, and you're like, great, and then you just turn up without any speech prepared, and they're like, let's see your speeches. What happens next?
Okay, well, it's a two-step, that was the callback, there was two auditions for the foundation. The first one, I just did a, I did like a spoken, I did like an appreciation of Faust by Punch Drunk, which I'd seen. This was, you know, and it made a big impression on me. And I talked about various aspects of it and how interesting it was and the staging of it, et cetera, et cetera.
So what, like a kind of like a review piece? Or
yeah, kind of like a yeah, exactly. Like a sort of, like a sort of a literature review of, you know, like if it was like I was doing English A-level and I wanted to talk about that theatre piece. But
and Lambda were just like, yeah, you can do that.
Yeah, that was on the list of things. I mean, this is the issue. I think on the list of things that you could do for first edition, something like that was allowed. And then it didn't mention for the callback what specifically you had to prepare. And I just didn't know.
Right.
And I didn't. I mean, I'm very naive, obviously. But...
So what happened? You get into the call. So you read out your, you know, your sort of essay. And then...
Yeah.
And then you they go, well, this kid is obviously excellent. Let's bring him back.
Well, they must be like, who is this guy? But I, yeah.
But then, you're in the room, and do they ask for your speeches again?
So, you know, in the second one, yeah, I'm in the room. I'm halfway down the line of 30, you know, wannabe foundation members. And I just say, oh, God, that feeling when they went, and now the speeches. And they were going down, and I was thinking, what am I going to say when it gets to me? I honestly, what am I going to do? And I think I said, I was, yeah, number 15. He went, so Josh, if you want to do your modern or whatever. And I went, I don't have anything prepared. But because it didn't stipulate that I had to, and I just didn't know on the callback thing. But if you want, I mean, I enjoyed that improv we just did. I could do more of that if that would suffice. And the guy was like, hold the phone, and then we'll come back to you at the end. So they went down the entire line and then came back to me at the end. And he, I can't remember which teacher it was, but he essentially auditioned, he interviewed me as if I were, he asked me to be one of my grandparents, my grandfather. And as Harry is aware, I did this bizarre caricature of a sort of, I mean, it really was like Mischief Movie Night In, a sort of bizarre caricature of an old man, just a generic old man.
Was it full of sort of tension?
It was so tense, and I was aware. I was like, "This isn't this." I was thinking to myself, "This doesn't correlate with any human I've ever met. What I'm doing right now," and it was just like, it was just this thing of the surreal. The fact I was in it, there were 30 like potential actors, or you know, that wanted to do this professionally, looking at me, just doing this bizarre caricature. And
of course they let you in, because like if I would watch that, I'd be like, We gotta get this guy in. Like, what?
Well, they must, yeah.
What's he gonna be doing?
Their minds must be like, who is this guy?
Why hasn't he prepared a speech?
Yeah.
Why is he just doing this? He's just doing an impression of his granddad. But then, in your defense, you know, the teacher obviously going, well, I'm going to interview you as your granddad. The teacher's presumably just thinking on the feet. Do you reckon was it Adam Megiddo? No, it wasn't.
I think it was, oh, God, I can't remember his name.
But Adam must have seen your audition, because like,
yeah, Adam would have done
your Adam's kind of guy, big time, like into that kind of abstract, slightly absurd, kind of fun, high energy. Like, I think he would have just been like, we got to get this guy.
At that age, I was always too high energy for Adam, and I knew that. You know, it was so unattainable. His love. I was like, you know, and I hope he listened to
him yesterday.
Oh, did you?
Yeah. And we talked a lot about teaching and stuff, and he I know what you mean, like a lot of people, he had that effect on a lot of people with just a lot of charisma, a lot of authority, and you're kind of trying to always he sort of ends up being a kind of father figure a little bit, and you want
certainly
you want his love.
the improv guru that you need to exactly have the approval of.
But he told me as well, he was like, he had only just started improv by the time he'd gone into Lambda. He was like, I wasn't really teaching you guys improv. I was learning it myself. So I was like, here's some stuff that I like to do.
That's very interesting. Because, I mean, so but had he just been working with Ken Campbell?
Yeah, because he came in, didn't he? Ken Campbell came into that.
That is an amazing experience that we had as well. Like Ken Campbell
screaming at us, no questions for 3 hours.
No questions.
No questions. Like, Ken, shut up. What did he make us do? He made us do, to count down out loud from 100 and write a Shakespearean sonnet, like make one up.
Yeah, that rings a bell.
With like AB rhymes and like 14 syllables a line and all that kind of stuff. It was impossible. And the whole time he was like, you've stopped counting. And it was just like, yeah, of course. What is this class? What is it? Yeah. What are we learning? But yeah, sorry, we've got sidetracked. So you got in. I'm just so pleased that you got in. And I'm just so pleased that you as like, what, a 20-year-old? Was just stood there with a bunch of other 18. Actors. 18. Fuck. And then just being like, yeah, I've not got anything prepared. But I quite like doing that. I'll do that again.
Yeah.
It's like, that's so good. I like the idea of like, it's like going into X Factor and being like, well, I've not got a song. I didn't know how to have a song, but I quite like queuing outside. So do you mind if I just join the queue again? And if I was Simon Cowell, I'd be like, yeah, we've got to let the queue guy in, even if he can't sing.
Yeah, I mean, it was outrageous. I don't think I would have got away with that. I mean, it wasn't like a conceit that I had planned to do that. I just didn't know, by the way.
But I think that's the thing. I think that's probably what got you in, isn't it? That real genuine, just like...
Yeah.
Because it's just for that whole audition process. I mean, I was definitely part of it. Just full of people trying way too hard and people trying to like be different and be noticed. And it's a huge high-pressure situation. And, like, and strangely, I think the more information you know, the less well you do. And actually you going into it being like, well, I don't fucking know, I'm just gonna do whatever the stuff that I like doing, they're probably like, great, this guy's got something really exciting.
The thing is, like, before that it was in the audition process, I didn't really know that I would, maybe I did, but I didn't even think about it, I didn't know about it, that I would love the improv. But I loved doing the improv in that audition. I was like, this is great,
this is really
sort
fun.
Of suits me,
I can just do what I want.
Yeah, so, just be silly.
So you get into Lambda, and then, yeah, what was your experience of that, of kind of performing and presumably then being around other people who were probably taking themselves quite seriously and wanting to kind of get onto the 3-year course?
I mean, obviously I met you, Henry Lewis, Harry Kershaw, Mike Bodie, as well as other great people. I think we had a particularly strong year as well, didn't we? I think like how many went into the 3-year at...
Quite a few, actually. It was like 15 odd out of about 30.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah, it was quite a lot.
But separate to that, I mean, maybe that's not even that informative. Just there were some big characters there, weren't there? And I think it was just such a great. I mean, some of it, I occasionally I thought, what am I doing? That, you know, when you're doing something just so silly,
just and then everyone's taking it seriously, or like breathing through your ass.
Yeah, that kind of thing.
Voice class. Yeah.
Breathing through your ass. Can I quickly? I learned recently. I've shared this with someone yesterday, but I just. Sorry. This is a massive detour, but it's just literally.
Is this a medical thing?
No, it's a biological, zoological thing. So okay. I saw a photo of a snapping turtle with a very large, underneath some ice on the internet with a guy like posing on top of the ice. I was like, what's going on here? And apparently it's amphibians are reptiles. They hibernate, and it's called brumating. I mean, that's the term for it.
Okay.
But I was like, how's this snapping turtle alive underneath the ice? And I looked it up, and apparently, well, first of all, turtles have a cloaca like a bird, one hole through which they do everything, excrete and, you know, have sex and lay eggs.
Perfect.
Second of all, they can brumate under the ice for months. And what they do is they breathe via their rectum. The water comes in through the cloaca, and oxygen exchanges with the rectus mucosa.
Oh, wow.
Isn't that the rectum mucosa?
It's like their kind of gills.
They normally breathe like, I assume, I think they have lungs normally. Well, they do still have them. They're just not using them. Isn't that mad? Just that diffusing.
So what, they can just convert, they can just take the oxygen out of the water through their arse.
Yeah. They're literally breathing through their arse, Dave. Sorry, that's why it came into my head.
There you go. And that's what they're trying to teach us at drama school.
Yeah. Be more like a snapping turtle.
Yeah. Well, I thought you were going to be like, oh, there's a hole in the ice and his ass was out the hole. And he was sort of like snorkeling through the ice with his ass.
That would also be impressive, to be fair.
It would. And also, how would he remain there hibernating? Presumably some sort of current would shift him. But that is amazing. Wow.
Sorry, I just wanted to share that and make sure that everyone knew about that that listens to this podcast.
No, this is very good. A fine detour.
What were we talking about?
We were, oh, yeah, so the foundation. You're in Lambda. Lots of big characters in there. And it's, yeah, I was kind of just curious about what your experience of it was, because presumably, like you said, you knew you were going to go to medical school. And so
yeah,
a lot of people either on the foundation course are there because they haven't got a place on the three-year course. And so they're anticipating auditioning next year for drama schools and trying to get on three-year courses. Or they're there to presumably promote some kind of foray into the acting world. But if you're there knowing that you're kind of exploring yourself in this part of you, going to be a doctor, yeah, what's your experience of that? Was it quite freeing?
Oh yeah. I mean, especially everything that we got out of it. I mean, going to Edinburgh every year during medical school was so great. I mean, it was the last sort of 2 to 3 years of medical school that became very serious. And I was like, oh my goodness, I don't know anything. And I need to buckle down and do lots and lots and lots of learning. But we were still managing to do the full Edinburgh thing. And it was those early years, Dave, as you know, that those will always be most deeply held in my heart, because the madness that we got up to, the stories and the images, I mean, a lot of them I've forgotten already, but
we were woefully underprepared for
what. Yeah, but it was so Edinburgh brilliant. Was.
Yeah.
And the fact that it wasn't about money, and it was just about the flyering. I mean, the aggressive flyering I was doing, and some of the things that I was doing as part of flyering, I don't know how I had the energy for it, or any of us did.
Flyering's a tricky one, because we were doing, sometimes 8-9 hours a day, and doing sort of promotional gigs.
You know,
sometimes up to like 10 gigs a day, sprinting across Edinburgh.
Well, I accidentally got us booted out from I've never been booted out of a shop window before, but from the shop window of one of the storefronts.
Yeah, was that the John Lewis thing?
Exactly. I wasn't sure if I should say the name, but
I don't know.
I said something fairly innocuous and someone took offence, but obviously I'm improvising.
That was it. So I should explain. Well, actually, you should explain. It's your podcast. You explain what happened. So we were asked to come and do like a promotional gig at John Lewis, right?
Yeah. I mean, it was just because it's just like off the corner. I feel bad. I mean, maybe I shouldn't advertise that I don't know, apparently said something that was so inflammatory that I got us banned from a storefront.
Well, I'm very pleased that you brought it up, because I remember you guys, because I wasn't doing that gig, I remember you guys being behind the glass of the storefront.
Yeah.
You were speaking into mics, and there was a PA system outside on
the street. That was right. So
the best thing about it was watching people come past, you guys improvising behind some glass, and I think me potentially getting suggestions from the audience and like screaming them through the window at you guys. And the problem was that as people were coming along, it wasn't clear where the voices were coming from. So people did want to stop and watch, but they were just like, where is this? And then eventually someone would be like, it's in the window of John Lewis. And then people were like, what are John Lewis doing?
Yeah, it felt especially weird that, of all the things we did. Didn't we do one on a racehorse track?
Yeah, we did. It was on the outskirts of Edinburgh. We talked.
Like, who's going to come from that? I mean, those people aren't going to be going to the Edinburgh Fringe anyway.
I don't know. You know, that was the thing. We got driven out, didn't we? It was like 20 miles outside of Edinburgh, and did a gig under a gazebo, at racehorse, like by the betting tables.
It was pissing rain, wasn't it?
Yeah. Oh man, that was horrible. But I think even then, I remember just like laughing and being like, "What is this?"
Well, exactly. The whole experience was so ridiculous, but so brilliant.
Well, I remember Henry Lewis kind of going, quite gung-ho and just booking absolutely everything under the sun.
That's the thing. Henry has just got this, something that I lack actually, which is just this kind of can-do attitude, which is borderline delusional. But you need that in this world to get ahead and make things happen. You need someone that's just going to be like, no, I don't care how ridiculous or stupid this idea is in terms of the likelihood of it working. I mean, this whole company has basically been built on a sort of, it's like a what's the word, like a sort of confidence trickster sort of pyramid scheme of delusional hope that this could work. Yeah. But it has worked.
It's a it's a sort of blind attack.
Yeah, but I mean, just the years of Mischief doing stuff for little or no money.
Yeah, I suppose it's probably like watching someone blindfold themselves and try and hit a baseball, and they just keep swinging, and eventually when they hit something, you're just like, wow, that's amazing. That's amazing that they've managed to do that because they were completely blindfolded. And I sort of think that's sort of what our journey's been a bit like.
But I do think that the improv has been an amazing training ground for reading an audience, getting the team that are tight and like know they're a good physically in a space comedically, and you know, get that timing together. And then, and some of the shows really do feel like the improv shows, don't they? Like if you took the highlights, in fact, some of them literally are highlights from some of the improv shows, just slightly twisted.
Well, yeah, we've got quite a few stuff lifted out of some of the improv and some of the improv we've done in the devising sessions. But also I think a part of the staple for Mischief as well is just going through those really, and there are a few of them, going through those really, really low sort of shows that are just absolutely soul shattering. And you're kind of doing them at sort of 2 o'clock in the morning because there are so many good experiences. Yeah. It's actually the really, really bad ones where it's just like me, you, Harry, Hen, or you know, whatever, just doing some absolutely sad gig and sort of laughing our way through it, going, we know this is bad, but we're committing to this, we're doing it, and then coming out of it and just sort of being able to laugh it off and enjoy it. And actually there's an element of doing those gigs where you kind of go, oh well, I know it can't really get any worse than that, so like what could I possibly be afraid of if I've got all of these people around me, and we go in an attack. Yeah.
And all, I think just in life in general, though, I try to have the mentality of anything that's sort of surreal, ridiculous, upsetting, often upsetting, or could be, you just sort of think that's one for the story bank. Like, this is a character building moment of absurdity.
Well, I think I would sort of describe your improv style as sort of unshakably playful. And I think it's interesting because I think there's only a few times where I've seen you either underconfident or not sure. And that only usually comes out of if you haven't been doing it for a while or that something's happened that sort of maybe knocked you off balance. And those kind of things are very, very rare. But actually, I think most of the time I see you kind of, yeah, I can see that attitude coming through actually, where you're just kind of going, okay, I'm just going to step into this and try and make it as fun as possible. And I think that's a really wonderful attitude to have. But do you think that's a way that you apply yourself to the shows?
So I suppose for me, recently especially, I am acutely aware that I'm incredibly lucky to have this as a sort of, this is underplaying it, but a release valve and also a whole expression of that side of me and my playfulness and my brain, which I don't get to use. Well, I say I don't get to use it at work, but I am often ridiculous at work. Probably shouldn't say that, but I mean, it's true. Just amongst the staff, I mean, I'm just an absurd human, and I'm aware of that, but I try to embrace it. But if you're not having fun doing the show, then what is the point? And and hopefully that translates. I think it does translate to for the audiences if you're vaguely into this kind of thing. But just like people throwing ourselves into danger and doing it joyfully.
Yeah, I think that is true. And we should say at this point, actually, so we're kind of coming up along to this in the timeline anyway, but so you are a fully qualified doctor.
I'm a medical doctor.
Medical doctor, you work in a hospital. You kind of said about you don't get to kind of use that part of your brain so much at work. What is your work? Tell us a bit about what kind of medicine, because I imagine there's loads of different types of medical doctor.
Yeah, so I am at the stage where when did I finish med school? Probably 6 years ago now. So I'm at the stage where it's just been rebranded to internal medicine training, which is what the Americans call it. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to be starting my specialty in August.
Exciting.
But at the moment you still do your rotations, so over Christmas, while doing Mischief Eve Night, I was on a rota in ITU. So it was especially surreal coming from that. some of the most tragic things I've had to deal with and see, and then going to be incredibly silly and mischievous night. I mean, it's a huge release, and again, I'm very grateful to have had that, because I do think it's been, and also the summer tour we did when the prevalence was low of SARS-CoV-2 in September, when we, you know, went around. Mm. That was so needed for me personally.
And how comfortable are you talking about what's happening in the hospital, particularly over those more stressful times?
I don't want to bum people out there listening to this. Maybe they want a bit of escapism, but I will happily talk about it. I think obviously it's been a crazy time.
I think it's important to kind of speak to someone kind of about, because you hear so much on social media, and there's a lot of misinformation, but also a lot of opinion, I think, as well. And obviously you're going to give your opinion, but I think if you're actually on the ward treating the patients, that's an invaluable insight, particularly for someone like me who is just seeing this play out on TV, essentially. Like, I'm very fortunate that I know less than 5 people who have actually got COVID. I don't know anyone who's passed away from it. Mm. So it would be really easy for someone like me to be like, oh, well, it's not that bad. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's not, it's all right, isn't it? And I'm sort of having to trust the people that I know. So what's been your experience of it, particularly in the last sort of few months?
This Christmas just gone was especially bad. In my hospital was, compared to sort of London hospitals in March, wasn't as badly hit, but it was still hit. Obviously, being in ITU, you see the people that are more likely to survive if they're requiring ventilation. So that's why they're there. So there were young people in their 30s and 40s who were otherwise well. Yeah. And every day is part of your, I think, the difficulty, because it's as part of self-preservation, you sort of turn off a part of your brain so that you can do the job, like, you know, turning patients over, which is part of the, like, treatment for COVID sometimes when their ventilation pressures are going up. Or
is that to help them breathe?
Yeah, it's to do with... it's to do with, like, the blood going to the affected part of the lung. Right. The most difficult part, I think, for me at least, was having to call or see in person the next of kin of those people, like the children or the brother or the sister or whoever of the people that were, you know, deteriorating. Mm. And that's not just in ITU, that would be on the wards as well, but that was just my experience most recently. Yeah,
and is it your job in that scenario to kind of tell them that the prognosis isn't good, and that looked like it's a bit of a one-way journey at the moment?
Yeah, it's very. I mean, it would always be. I hate prognosticating in general, because I don't think I think that it's often very, very difficult, and you break the sort of trust between you and either a patient if they're awake or the next of kin if you say something with confidence and it doesn't happen. So I think it's important, you know, that I think this pandemic has been a good exercise in understanding the sort of how risk works and, like, probability. Nothing's definite. It's sort of a range of certainty. And trying to translate that in a sort of, I mean, it's really hard. I mean, when you tell someone that their mum is possibly not going to recover, especially over the phone. And it's a bizarre experience, especially, and also you're doing it day after day with the same people. So you're, like, building up a sort of weird relationship, and yet, you know, and then when you see the faces of the families when they come in, we were only letting people in. Sorry, this is so depressing, potentially. I don't know if people want to.
It's good. Okay. I think I'm very interested by it personally. If no one else wants to do it, it's fine.
Yeah. Okay. I think that actually being confronted with the faces of the next of kin that came in, that they're only allowed to come in because of COVID restrictions towards the end of life for the patients, it really hits home, and it's almost like too much to process.
For you personally, or for the families?
Both.
And so do you have a... is there a part of you that you worry that would become almost insensitive to these kind of things? Because, like you say, you kind of have to turn a part of yourself off. And eventually, like, if enough patients deteriorate or enough patients pass away, does it feel like they become statistics, or do you kind of, does each one feel like a new kind of blow to the sort of your morale?
So I think that, so first of all, actually, we discussed this, the ICU team discussed this, and I've discussed with the doctors this before, this sort of professional, emotional, what's the word I'm looking for? And you have to develop a hardening so that you can not become emotionally invested with each person at the same time. In order to empathize, yeah, you need something there to prevent yourself from feeling every hit because you just couldn't do your job. So it is essential to have a sort of fader switch on your empathy. And sometimes that's impossible because in order to talk to another human being and really connect with them, that is empathy. But then for the rest of the time, you're doing the functional part of the job and you can't just be wallowing in the misery of the situation. Otherwise you wouldn't get anything done. So it is, yep. It's like a skill to sort of switch in and out of that. And sometimes that armor breaks. And I heard a story ages ago about this is pre-COVID, but a consultant who only spoke German with her family. And I think this is in England. So she would consult in English and medicine's in English, but they needed someone to translate for an elderly patient who only spoke in German. Mm-hmm. And as soon as she was there translating from German to English, just the fact that she was doing that, she accessed a different part, an emotional part of her brain, and just started weeping because she was talking about end of life decisions with this elderly German woman. And I think that's like it's one single example, but it's how I see it. This sort of compartmentalization, but we're all human.
An element of conditioning to it, where you kind of aware, you kind of have to change your mental map a little bit in order to kind of cope with the trauma of everyday decisions.
You definitely slip into a role which you like me in work. I slip into a doctor role because you have to, especially when I'm sort of now I'm occupying maybe more of it because I'm talking about it.
Yeah,
you know that. I mean, obviously, I need to. I couldn't just be Josh the improviser at work, and probably wouldn't fly. But
what I was going to say, is there like an element? Is there a sort of Patch Adams element to your?
So part of being a good doctor. I'm not saying I'm a good doctor, although I hope I am. Is that you immediately try to read a patient on what you think they need and want in that moment. And I would say that I, towards a sort of more colloquial, cheeky, charming, sort of jokey kind of side, with colleagues and with patients. And if they respond well, then great. Some people are not in the right place for that, and I respect that. But
people want a more of a cold, professional approach.
Well, yeah, they just want. Well, obviously, it's not appropriate sometimes if someone's in a really dark place. But sometimes you just need. You need to know that you're being looked after by humans. I think I'd want a human looking after me.
Yeah, I think it's quite easy to. I'm finding that a lot as COVID tolerance wanes, that there is a tendency now to start seeing particularly doctors and sometimes policemen and basically public sector workers I think we're starting to dehumanize them sometimes. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a really dangerous thing. There are lots of people obviously still that are showing huge support, but I think, it must be quite hard for you when you're in a position where you're like, well, I have all this knowledge and all this skill, but I am still a person. Mm. It must be kind of a strange environment to be in.
And there's something else that you were saying about the sort of emotional content of what you see. I think in terms of what I've seen, some people's opinions and the fact that some people are in denial about, even that COVID exists or seemingly take riskier and riskier behaviours in terms of, at the height of the... when the prevalence was at its highest over winter, whatever. I think that if there's not an emotion, I think this is a human trait generally, if there's not an emotional connection to seeing the reality of it, if it's just a number, then it's very hard to sort of have meaning. But if you have an interaction with a single person that's dying of COVID, then it suddenly takes on a whole different narrative. And if you could just see the human story behind the people that are affected, I think for me personally, that's that would be enough to change my behaviours. And you're right. I think if people, especially, if there's, because it's true that younger people, thankfully, younger people aren't as at risk. And thank goodness for vaccination coming in as quickly as it has. I didn't think it would come in as quickly as it did here.
Mm. You're doing very well. So is that, yeah. Is that kind of what you would say to the skeptics or the deniers or the people whose behavior is adapting, is encourage them to look past the statistics? It's not just, you know, 120,000-130,000 people dead. It's like each one of them is a living person who now no longer lives.
Well, I mean, but equally me saying that, I don't know if that would be enough or sufficient, because unless you've actually seen it, that's why I think it was good. It was very late in the day, I think because they didn't want to upset people or whatever, but the decision for media crews to go in and film on intensive care units or general medical wards, the COVID general medical wards, which are mostly, thankfully, not needed at the moment as prevalence goes down. It's very hard, unless you see those images, to take it on board. I don't think any human saying, but you should X, Y, and Z, or this is the situation. Although I can tell you from my own personal experience, it is horrific, and it is not, it's not pleasant at all for anyone involved. And also just all the sadness around it. I mean, not just the patient, just the families and all the other people affected and not being able to come to hospital, and it goes on and on.
Yeah, it kind of has a ripple effect further out than just you and the patient. It's sort of, there's more stuff around it, I guess, that people probably don't take into consideration when they're looking at those statistics or making choices about what they should be doing with their day. But thank you very much for talking about that. I imagine it's not easy, and it's really it's really interesting to hear as well, because there are so many people who aren't on the front line, and having a direct source of information. What a privilege. That's exclusive here. Dave Hearn podcast, Mischief Makers,
we're gonna
be number one news story. let's actually now we're sort of coming into the final 10 minutes or so.
Hello, Dave.
And let's explore some questions from the web. So what I'm doing here brilliantly is I brought us down emotionally to quite a somber place, and I'm now going to rely on you to lift us back out of that,
to bring it back up
with a new jingle for Questions from the Web is your title.
Questions from the Web.
Nice. Sort of falsetto, lovely vibrato, very nice.
I was trying to channel the Bodyform commercial from the early 90s, but yes, in a sort of more subtle, the sort of orchestral version.
Yeah, I could hear that. Great. And you did well with only one instrument. Very good.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
So let's have a look. So, we're keeping on the medical theme. This is from Sophie. She asks, have you ever had a patient recognize you from a Mischief show?
I don't think so, unless they...
Is that a good thing?
I think it would be quite bizarre to recognize me if you were my patient as this like ridiculous cartoon man.
Well, you probably wouldn't make the connection, would you? You probably wouldn't be like,
that's it. I think you're right.
I think, can't be a doctor.
Yeah. I mean, I get that a lot anyway, Dave, to be honest.
That's true. I mean, if I saw the papal enforcer walk into my room, I wouldn't be like, I should say, for those of you who did watch it, Josh played a character called the papal enforcer, which was a madness, a joyous madness. Mm. But yeah, if the papal enforcer walked in and was just like, "Hi, I'm Dr. Elliot. I'm here to ask you," I would be like, "Are you? You can't be the papal enforcer. You're a doctor. That's a silliness." So I suppose it might be a sort of plausible deniability in a way.
Yeah, and I do think that there's a lot of how our brains work that require contextualization. And why would I be there?
That's true. That is very true. Well, there you go, Sophie. The answer is probably not. And if
hopefully not. Hopefully never. Yeah,
let's hope not. Well, again, let's stick with this as well. So Kerry asks, we've kind of touched on this already, but do you find you need comedy as a relief from your job, or do you manage to switch off easily because you love doing the show so much?
I think short term, there's a bit of, I have to switch off quickly, but then I think it has long-term repercussions. And yes, definitely at work, just generally, like, I mean, not with patients, but I think comedy is very important for like team rapport for me. Mm. And, again, much like with Mischief, I think we should try and have as good a time as possible, whatever we're doing, and enjoy life as much as possible. So yes, definitely.
Yeah, I think I would agree with that. Well, there you go, Kerry. You heard it here first. Next up, this one is from Sarah. She asks, what did you find most different and most challenging about performing in the live stream compared to when it was in person last year?
Well, initially, obviously, I joined after, I think you guys had done a couple of shows already on the Mischief Night Inn. So at least it felt like someone knew what they were doing by that point. You know what I mean?
But we knew that the feeling of it was intense. Yeah.
I think early days before just getting used to someone hitting a button to mix live pre-recorded laughter from our previous stage shows was quite surreal. And often made me laugh quite a lot in the middle of a scene, just like that just fake feedback.
Yeah. Someone else. It's just like, how funny is Simon finding it? Because he's just pressing a button to make laugh.
Yeah, it did feel a bit like a Black Mirror scene or something.
But I
felt quite... I mean, basically, I think it ended up being quite a sort of like a fun, high-stakes rehearsal. You know, when you're, you know, just having a nice time amongst us before a show, like the day before, and we haven't done it for a while. We're getting back on our feet. So there's that slight pressure to be good.
You're not getting the feedback from the audience, so always in rehearsals it felt really bad.
We're
just trying to get used to that with no audience.
But equally, then it just gives you carte blanche to just go in full. I mean, if you're going to do something, do it with commitment, because you don't know either way.
Yeah, it could be bad, it could not be, but you're not going to know, so you know, you treat both imposters the same.
Yeah,
very good. I wouldn't actually usually ask this question. This one is from Liz. Because it's a bit of a tough one to put people on the spot, but I feel like you would be good at this. It's quite simple. It's, what is your favourite random fact that you know?
Oh, well, I shared one earlier about butt breathing.
Yeah, breathing through the arse. I mean, if you've got another one, we can use the arse breathing as your...
I mean, that's just the recent one. I've got so many. I love random facts. That's the thing.
But is that, would you say that's one of your favourites, the arse?
Well, that one's come into my life in the last couple of days, so it's there, the front of the prefrontal cortex, you know. Can I think about that one as we talk, and maybe
circle back.
I'll let it mull.
So Alex asks, well, Alex states initially, absolutely stand out in Mischief Movie Night. Now, I assume Alex is talking
for a positive
about
way. Yeah, hopefully.
Alex might very well be talking about me. Who knows?
Or he might be saying, you were really subpar, Josh. Like,
you
really.
You really stood out.
Like a sore, really, unpleasant...
Yeah, a really lackluster performance.
Hopefully not.
But this is Alex's question. How do you balance the chaos and hilarity in your improv so it's not too over the top, but it's genuinely funny and spontaneous? Is it something you are actively aware of, or is it just instinct? I didn't mean to ask that so sarcastically, Alex. That's a very good question. I apologise. I feel like quite a cynical tone.
I feel like you've automatically questioned the validity of the underlying assumptions in that question.
Yes, who are you, Alex, to say these things? Yeah, it's just like, how do you imbalance, you know, the chaos and the hilarity, making it genuinely funny? But it's a very good question, because I would say you like, to describe someone's performance as quite chaotic is quite a negative thing, but I would say you managed to balance it really, really well. There's a joyous chaos, but it is funny, and it does feel really spontaneous. Do you think it's something, I guess what Alex is asking, is it something that you actively pursue that, or is it just part of your instinct, you just get in there and do whatever?
I think that when I was 18, 19, 20, I would have too much of a sort of giving motor mouth, you know. So in recent years, I've tried to be like that coiled perfect spring of being ready to come in with the madness that is just whirring constantly up there, but then having the discipline to stop after short bursts. I mean, you feel it in the room, don't you? It's funny about that, because again, without an audience, you know, you would have thought the audience would be integral to feeling that energy, but just amongst us, you know, when there's a short little moment for you to nip in with something and then get out. Ken Campbell used to say, what did he say about be fun, get on, be funny, and F off? David? Oh, David. Are you muted?
Oh, I was just talking there. But what I did was I had myself on mute.
I'm so sorry for you.
No, it was me. You missed some absolute gold.
Tell me.
Well, I actually knocked something over, so it was quite good that it was on mute. So I'm quite glad. But yeah, it was Be Fast, Be Funny and Fuck Off. And it was applying that to all forms of theatre, even if it's like straight theatre and, you know, serious pieces.
Just storytelling and interactions with people. Just give the nuggets of truth and go away. And also in medical handovers, don't give the background stuff you don't need to hear. Just give the salience.
Give the salience, get the fuck out of there. Be hilarious.
Yeah. Hopefully drop in a blinder of a joke and then go away.
I suppose is a medical equivalent of a mic drop, just dropping the little clipboard with all the information on it.
Clipboard. Only F1s, first year doctors. I mean, that would be the... I say only, that's not fair. A dear friend of mine who is a registrar still has a clipboard because she's a very organised woman.
Sure.
But, I mean, typically the stereotype would be that your first year doctors still have clipboards because they are the ones that are doing all the unpainful admin. But I do feel sorry for medical students about to start F1. It is like a hazing to join a club.
A lot of admin.
But it's not just admin, because you also do the on-calls, and some of the most scary moments of my medical career to date have been during my first year of medicine. Partly maybe because I knew less, but also partly because it is just hard.
Yeah, you've got it's a bit of a trial by fire.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, we are rapidly running out of time.
Oh, goodness, Dave. We're only just getting into the good stuff.
We are. Now, the final section, which we're going to have to literally do in like a minute.
Okay.
Luckily, it's called the quick fire section. So give us a quick fire jingle.
Put them up, cowboy.
I heard you laughing as you said cowboy. Put them up, cowboy. And also, it's okay that you didn't say quick fire, but I quite like the idea of, I suppose if I was like, this is the quick fire round, put them up, cowboy. That would be good, wouldn't
okay.
it?
Okay, I'll put it on at the end and then you can use that for all future jingles because I think that this is genuinely good.
Okay, yeah, we can do this. Okay, ready? Here we go. We're ready for the... So, do your jingle. I'm going to introduce it. You do your jingle, ready? So this is, ladies and gentlemen, the quickfire round.
Put them up, cowboy. Quickfire!
Nice. Very nice. Okay, here we go. I'm going to just ask you a bunch of questions. First thing that comes into your head. Are you ready?
Okay. Wow, okay.
All right. What is your favourite colour?
Turquoise. It's not true.
Texting or talking?
Talking.
If you were an animal, what would you be?
Llama.
If you could describe yourself as a dessert, what would you be?
Chocolate cheesecake.
If you were one of the 52 playing cards, which one would you be?
Too boring. Jack of hearts.
Is a Jaff cake a cake or a biscuit?
It is most definitely a cake.
Describe yourself in three words.
Joshua motherfucking Elliot.
Nice. What is in your pockets right now?
Literally nothing but air.
And finally, who from Mischief would you want to be trapped on a desert island with?
Oh, dear. I can't answer that.
And you can't say
it's like making me choose between my children.
Yeah, that's true. That is true. I've always said Mike Bodie.
But anyway, from a practical point of view, yeah, before you'd even got on the island, he would have already built a 5-star shack and have coconut martinis. Is that a thing? Yeah. Waiting.
Well, it is now. He's like, I wouldn't drink that martini though, because if Boat has invented it, there's gonna be something.
There's gonna be guaranteed food poisoning, but it'll be delicious.
100%.
You know what they say: moment on the lips, lifetime in the grave.
Lifetime dead in the grave after drinking a toxic martini. And finally, before we wrap it up, have you got any sort of media recommendations for people in TV, books, podcasts, anything you want to push? Music, anything people should listen to, read, watch, experience?
Well, check out my band that I mentioned, even though we're not playing currently, but maybe one day, The Joker and the Thief. Check out the last book, I really enjoyed it because it's written like poetry, is the, my friend gave it to me to read, There's a series of books by Carlo Rovelli, who's a theoretical physicist, and they basically, a bunch of them are on the same thing about gravity and Einstein's theorems and more, and the nature of time. And there are different like levels of hardness, but I really enjoyed reading them.
Carlo Rovelli. Very good. Sounds good. Well, wonderful. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for listening. Josh Elliott, thank you very much for
talking. Thank you for listening, and thank you for having me on, Dave.
It's been absolutely wonderful. Do keep an eye out for all of our episodes. You can follow Josh on Twitter. I should have your Twitter handle up here, actually, and see if I can find it. Do you know what yours is?
It's at Dr. Dr. Joshua Elliott. Two L's, two T's.
There you go. Follow him on Twitter for all the latest medical bants. And
That was like a siren.
That was very good. And you can give us a kind of the sort of catchphrase is keep making mischief. Do you want to give us a keep making mischief, either like a jingle or like a, I don't know.
Okay.
You know.
Woo! Keep making mischief.
Perfect.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.